Hello and welcome to another episode of New Books in Terrorism and Organized Crime, part of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Mark Locks. Today we talk to Antonio Gistozzi about his new book, The Art of Coercion. This is an excellent book about the nature of how organizations obtain and maintain their monopoly over violence in their community. Now, it doesn't sound like something we would normally talk about on this channel, but when you think about the fact that terrorist groups and organized crime groups are effectively challenging a government's monopoly on violence, this is excellent background material that can help inform the way you think about these organizations. Antonio has a strong background in history, and he does work in Afghanistan at the moment, and in fact is leaving in a couple of days after this interview to go back to Afghanistan. I found the book absolutely fascinating, and the interview was extremely interesting, so I hope you enjoy it. Hello and welcome to New Books in Terrorism and Organized Crime, and today we're talking to Antonio Gistozzi in London, and we're going to talk about his new book, The Art of Coercion. Hello, Antonio. How are you?
How are you?
How are things over there in London?
I haven't been out yet, but they look more or less normal.
Normal? Normal London weather? Summer? Yes. Okay, to get things started, why don't we start with just a quick bio of what your background is and how you came to write this book?
Well, my background, I'm an historian by training, but I'm on loan, so to speak, or I've been on loan to political science for quite a few years, mainly because there's not much employment for historians, and fundraising is even more difficult than in other academic specializations. But the book itself is a result of 6 years I spent at the Cardiff States Research Centre at LSE,
which is now the London School of Economics.
Yeah. I mean, the centre now has closed down because the funding ran out. But particularly during the last 5 years of the centre existed for 10 years, but only joined in its fifth year. We had a program on security and state building, so the role of the security apparatus in state formation and state building processes. And I was running that, and there were a lot of discussion with colleagues, with the team of people, mostly from either the UK, of course, or Colombia or Africa, who are contributing the different perspectives on various issues. So we had a lot of workshops, roundtable discussions, and of course, one of the things I was doing was surveying all the literature relevant to the topic. So out of the discussions and this little survey, I decided that I wanted to put that down in writing, and it started as a few papers which were circulated among ourselves, and then it developed into the book.
Good, good. And I'll just give a brief introduction to the people listening that the reason we're discussing a book about state building is that we're talking about the monopoly of power of states, the monopoly on the use of violence. And obviously terrorist groups and organized crime groups are key people who are in opposition to that monopolization of violence. But the book concentrates quite heavily on how an organization obtains and maintains that monopolization of violence. Would that be a correct summary?
Yeah. I mean, basically, once you start looking at things in depth, you realize that what we take for granted, you know, the monopoly of violence is never to be taken for granted. You know, we see even now, as we speak, you know, like, for example, in Syria, we see that even countries where the monopoly of violence seem to be assured, if not much else, that took a disintegrate very easily. And as you know, many of the insurgents now fighting in Syria are coming from the Syrian army. So maintaining control over the professionals of violence is not that easy. It's not as easy as we assume in the West. So as an important factor in the process of state formation or early state building, with any, let's call him a ruler or politician, has to consider. And of course, in cases of intervention from abroad, international intervention, there's also something to be considered. Yeah, so we know in Iraq, for example, there is a lot of tension over the security apparatus, with the Prime Minister Maliki in recent months trying to synchronize it with himself, basically. So there's always an issue that is there, and it does affect imposter state building much more than much of the, let's call it, orthodox literature seems to assume. So that's why I thought, you know, we have to, you know, there is literature about the subject, but the idea was to pull it together and integrate it with my own experience of research in Afghanistan and the experience of our colleagues at the Center, Colombia, Africa, mainly.
Right. So to get things rolling, how is it that any group actually does obtain this monopoly of violence in the first place? What are the steps they have to go through to obtain it?
Well, the first part of the book is actually about state formation, and this is what we today would probably call a civil war. Yeah, just a second. You know, of course, the book is based on generalizations, so it's based on surveys, mainly on the historical literature, and see what the most common paths to state formation are. In reality, of course, you could argue that every state had a somewhat different path to state formation. There are some which were not so violent. Now, generally speaking, the process of state formation is a very violent process, where a process of accumulation, essentially, of the means of violence, but not only, of financial means, you know, political power take place, up to the point where you have a critical mass where somebody becomes dominant. Either through purely military means, sometimes it happens that it's just a purely military process of accumulation, or through the ability of forming alliances among key players, which doesn't mean inclusive alliances, you know, but essentially diplomacy and alliance formation as a tool to gain an edge over the rivals. Mm-hmm. So these are complex processes, of course. And one of the main points I'm making is that we can look at the military side or the political side or the economic side in isolation. These are all, in this stage in particular, they're all closely related, because the economy in state formation is a function of the accumulation of military means, essentially.
Right. But once they obtain it, sorry, go on.
But basically that, because in New York there is a literature, particularly in recent years, has been looking at civil wars from the economic side. And that's been useful, but then there's been a tendency to drift, I think, too far, arguing that essentially these wars are motivated economically, that the players in these wars are accumulating money for the sake of accumulating money, not as a tool to wage war or to acquire supremacy in a civil war. And I think, you know, there may be cases, you can always find some cases of war profiteers, but then focus too much on those cases might be misleading, because we see the clear organizations, terrorist organizations, you want to call it, insurgent organizations, they're certainly involved in smuggling, in extortion, etc. And there have been cases within this organization of people who started enjoying it, and they went rogue, even from the perspective of their own leadership. But by and large, these organizations always are very clear that this financial accumulation was for the purpose of waging war, and the money has been reinvested in the war. You know, so there was a political aim there. It was not just for the sake of making money. Because, of course, you know, depending on how you interpret this process of financial accumulation in civil war, the kind of, you know, prescription that you might suggest also vary. You know, if you think that these are all a type of economic entrepreneurs who are only there for the money, the kind of, if you like, reconciliation that you might conceive is going to be different from what you will conceive if you assume that instead there are political aims there. You know, so you target a political settlement or an economic settlement, depending on what the interpretation is. So it's not just an academic point. It's very policy relevant. And my view is that, you know, there's been a tendency to overestimate the economic motivation in much of the recent literature, whether Afghanistan or, you know, other cases.
Mm-hmm. I had a student who worked on Abu Sayyaf as a group in the Philippines, and was trying to determine whether they'd become a organized crime group rather than a terrorist or insurgent group. And she found that it was actually, she thought, a split between two factions within the same organization, one still committed to the cause, and another one, which, as you say, was enjoying making the money, especially from kidnapping tourists.
Yeah, I mean, these things do happen, and we've seen the historical cases, the Maoists in Bangladesh, for example, which, you know, declined into essentially a group of gangs extorting money at the fringes of the Bangladeshi territorial state, you know, in more remote areas. There have been other cases in Latin America, you know, but this is, you know, essentially my point is that a movement that becomes too obviously involved in money making is finished as a serious insurgency, because people, you know, the rank and file is not going to die for somebody making money. So there has to be a sense of fairness. It's like in any military organization, if the foot soldiers perceive that the generals, so to speak, are, you know, enjoying good life and exploiting them, the organization is bound to collapse sooner or later, you know. So that's why, you know, it can happen, but by the time it happens, you have rump organizations that are not really a security threat anymore.
Right.
So it normally can be assessed relatively easily, you know, because you start having the factors that have people coming out and talking and sharing experiences. So distinguishing between the two is, I think, relatively easy.
Mm-hmm. And once an organization actually obtains this monopoly of violence, how do they actually maintain the monopoly? You've got quite a long section in the book on that particular situation.
Well, of course, my point is that there are a range of options that are available to, you know, new rulers, how they might be able to secure a degree of control over the security force. And it also depends on many factors, you know, the external environment, whether there is or not a serious security threat. It could be an external threat, it could be an internal threat. In many cases, there is not, you know, so some countries can afford to have very unprofessional armies that are used for essentially distribution of patronage, apparently without serious existential risk. But of course, this is not always the case. So when you are facing a serious threat, then you offer to take care of the effectiveness of your security apparatus. And loyalty and effectiveness tend to be in contradiction with each other. Yeah? Because if you promote meritocracy within an organization, then you do reduce your control over it. Because essentially, to promote meritocracy, you have to institutionalize it. And that means that you surrender control to a machine, to a mechanism. Yeah, so you, the politician, no longer can make arbitrary appointments. Yeah, you need to play by the rules if you want meritocracy to be there. And that, of course, implies a political cost. You particularly in early state building, inevitably, quite a large amount of state resources go into the security sector. So you're effectively surrendering one of the main potential sources of patronage to a mechanism that is not compatible with patronage on a large scale. So you're creating an institution. And creating an institution is actually a, you know, benign development from the perspective of state building. But in the short term, could actually cost very dearly to politicians who have to show up their political position. They would otherwise use security apparatus as a tool to bargain with, you know, different factions, reward loyalists, make unhappy people happy, you know, with appointments, etc., etc. So that's why it doesn't always happen. You know, you would think, why should anybody resist or oppose institutionalization processes in new states? it seems too obvious that this is a path to success. You know, you're going to have not only the security apparatus, you're going to have strong institutions, is what you want. This is the developmental path as experienced in the Western world and much of East Asia in recent history. So it seems counterintuitive. You know, why doesn't everybody go down that way? Particularly when is advised by Western advisors to do so, and is given billions of dollars to do so. Why still they don't do it? And so essentially in the book I argue that there's a contradiction between the short-term interests of the ruling elite in many cases. In fact, I would say always, because even in Western Europe, we have this problem. It's not been totally abolished. In some cases, say Southern Europe is more obvious, but we know that wherever you go, you will find sometimes politicians trying to, you know, break the rules, if you like, deinstitutionalize and promote their own proteges, you know, political appointees, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, you know, it's a matter of scale, and the scale can vary hugely. But the problem is this everywhere. In the book, I'm making the point that particularly in environments where the ruling elite is weak, doesn't have solid roots, the political settlement is shaky, then the competition to strengthen the personal base of support of various leaders can override consideration like, you know, let's have an effective security apparatus. And this is experienced clearly in Afghanistan today, you know, where even now as we speak, big debate is going on over new appointments at the top of the security apparatus, with the foreign advisors arguing in favor of certain personalities that, you know, they judge to be the professional ones. And the president has been resisting. Now apparently he's giving way. He's appointing some professionals at the top of the police and the army. But it's been 11 years of attempts to convince him. And we still don't know how it ends. So I think that this is a problem that, you know, when you try to explain certain patterns, you have to look at the way the ruling elite sees things, yeah, to explain how they behave. Doesn't mean to justify or sympathize with them, but you have to understand how they see things from their own personal and organizational perspective, rather than from an astral perspective of state building.
And it must be much more complex in a place like Afghanistan, with a huge range of different groups in the society. There's no sort of homogenous community in the country that can all say, here is one army, that will be our army. They've all got different competing goals and interests in their local and even the extended region.
Well, I mean, of course, in some countries which are more homogeneous, the process historically has been easier. Say, Scandinavian countries, yeah? These are small countries, almost entirely homogeneous ethnically, in a way it is not the case, or was not the case in Finland. They had a more troubled history, in fact, you know, including a civil war, you know, just after the October Revolution. So these patterns vary widely, but of course, you know, small, homogeneous communities with strong identity are not the rule, they are the exception, yeah, if you take the world as a whole. So, of course, you know, the case of internal intervention is much more likely to happen in places where instability has been a rule rather than the exception. There have been, you know, virtuous exceptions in a relatively recent time, like Switzerland, which is not, you know, would not appear to be a case of a country bound to succeed as such, given its ethnic dishomogeneity, you know, and the fact they're surrounded by countries which share ethnic and cultural connection with his own communities. And of course, you know, it has not always been a success case, you know. So, you know, even cases which seems to be doomed to failure, it's all a matter of the institutional engineering and the political settlement that you can work out. That's why the book might, you know, look pessimistic to some, but it's not meant to be pessimistic. It's meant to be a realistic look at what the challenges are there, you know, to be faced. What what kind of challenges will be there on the ground, even a country like Afghanistan could, in my view, succeed. You know, there is no environment where failure is inevitable. Certainly, there are environments where success is much more difficult, and one has to be aware of that. You know.
Right, right. I often see people on television in Egypt and in Afghanistan when they're talking to local people saying, what do you want? Do you want democracy? Do you want this? They say, well, first we want stability. And a monopoly of violence must play a pretty major role in providing and maintaining stability in any community.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, in reality, even in, say, Western Europe, it's not that... when what we describe today as a process of state building started, anybody had clear mind what they want or where they were getting to. You know, so today, of course, we can experience of the developed world if you are in Africa, in Afghanistan, or you know, in other parts of Asia, then you have a model to follow. But in reality, we know that when you follow a model, and that happens all the time, because even in Europe, the states of today are the result of various imitation processes. Yeah, so who inspired the German unity? It might seem a paradox looking at the last 200 years of history, but it was France. I mean, not necessarily in a positive way. It was the Napoleonic invasion that prompted it, and the movement towards German unity. So there are many not so obvious ways to which imitation can take place. It could be imitation of a positive model. It could be a reaction to a negative model or to an aggression. So the strength of the states in Europe is actually the result of the competition and reciprocal aggression that's been taking place over the centuries. And that's why the two strongest states in Europe are France and Germany, because they're the ones that fought each other with greater determination over the centuries. I think the patterns can vary widely, and this causes a problem, because when you carry out international intervention, you need to have a strategy, you need to have a focus, and you're not you don't want results like the results of American intervention in Vietnam, which you did create a very strong state, but not a friendly strong state. So it was an unexpected outcome, in a sense a benign outcome, because if there's going to be long-term development in Vietnam, it's probably the result of the strong state which was created in the north as a result of American intervention. It's probably, in the long term, more developmental than South Vietnam, even if South Vietnam seemed to be flourishing at that time, mainly because of, you know, money coming from the states. But, of course, it's not something that it would be acceptable as a state. Strategic plan in international intervention. So if tomorrow we are intervening in Iran, for example, we might strengthen in the long term the Iranian state, but not in a way that would be beneficial to Western strategic interests for the next 30 or 40 years. So that's the big problem that international intervention in failed states has to face. The fact that although in abstract it might actually contribute to create strong states locally, in political and diplomatic terms, that could be exactly the contrary of what you want. And that's one of the contradictions that has been faced, you know, in places like Iraq. Who's going to create a strong state in Iraq? The Western liberals or communist fundamentalists? Probably the answer is the second type of guy. So is what you want? And the contradiction now you see Maliki making, you know, carrying out his best efforts to create a strong state around himself in Iraq. Of course, that is quite controversial in this state, because he's not the kind of guy originally expected to, you know, to have succeeded in Iraq. So, but these are the most typical outcome, particularly when your initial analysis and understanding of what the potential local political factions and organization is. You know, so if you look at intervention naive terms, you think, you know, oh, we're going to empower some, you know, pro-Western liberals, but it's not likely to work, because in this situation of state formation and state building, it will not be the soft Western liberals who succeed. You know, it's going to be a power struggle where the most ruthless and best organized guys will win. This is a problem that has now to be addressed.
Yep. Oh, I mean, it's always quite amazing when I used to watch American news channels where they'd say, well, we need to institute a democracy so that we'll have a replica of a Western-style democracy in the country that's there. But if the people who vote for a different style of government, there's no guarantee of what that government's going to be just because you have a particular system in place. Which brings us to what is my most, I think, the most interesting part of your book, the situation on the monopoly of violence, where that monopoly is actually held by an external government, where external government support or actually external government troops are providing the monopoly in the community.
Right. Well, yeah, that, of course, was a matter of particular interest to me, because as I was writing the book, I'm still working in Afghanistan, where you see all the dysfunctionalities deriving from taking over the security apparatus of a host country. This is quite obvious in Afghanistan. It was obvious in Iraq. And in Iraq, of course, is also interesting, but of course it's more difficult now to obtain information about what's going on within the Iraqi security apparatus, because the Westerners are not there to somehow report or leak information about what's happening. Of course, there is something going on. There is a realignment within the security apparatus going on in Iraq. I think as Western disengagement take place in Afghanistan, you will see the same, because I think it's inevitable. But many of the dysfunctionalities that were there will be difficult to resolve. And that's because, in a sense, building a effective and capable institution in general, and particularly a military institution, is difficult. You know, it's not kind of natural process where you leave them be, you let them be, and it will happen. It's not like a flower, you know, growing in the garden. It's actually a process where you have to make political sacrifices if you are a political elite. You know, you need to surrender some of your arbitrary power to the process of institutional development, which, as I mentioned before, you know, means that you have less patronage to distribute to consolidate your political position. It is actually politicization itself. You know, finding the right people for the right job is not so easy, particularly in a country as you would expect after a long civil war. Human resources will be scarce, so you have to allocate managerial capacity, human resources to a military institution, which could come at the expense of economic development, for example, yeah? Because the central government will not be able to mobilize a lot of management capacity. First of all, there might not be a lot in the country. Even what is there might not be interested in working for the government. Or if you want to make them interested in working for the government, you have to restrain private enterprise, because you can always make more money if you're a good manager in the economy than in the army. You know, so if you have few resources, because only a small portion of the population has been to school, so has been mobilized economically, then you have to decide what you want. Do you want a strong military institution? Do you want a flourishing economy? In the case of Afghanistan, we see that the government has made the decision to let the economy flourish. The result is that they can't recruit people in the police and the army with any management capacity or any educational background. They can't recruit people even from high school, let alone university, into the army. So they're recruiting, 90% of the recruits are illiterate. So on that basis, building a strong institution with several layers of bureaucratic control, you know, all the kind of things that you would want to create reliable institutions is impossible, essentially. They can't even develop their own logistics, leaving aside the bureaucratic admin side. So these are difficult decisions to be made, and there's always a trade-off. So some countries, and I mentioned some before, some countries have, in the early stages of state building, decided, no, we want to have a strong military institution, because without that, we can't rest assured in this international environment that anything else would hold. Now, some of these are bad examples. Yeah. So some of these are military dictatorships. There are some examples which I mentioned in the book. They're not so negative. Say Tanzania. Now, Tanzania is a country which economically has not been doing very well. Maybe just now it's beginning to grow more rapidly. But, you know, for the first 30 or so years after independence, actually economically doing pretty poorly. No major disaster, but stagnation over many years. But they created a military establishment which was under very tight political control of the political elite. Did pretty well the few times that it was actually used in war. So in Uganda, they did pretty well. And maintained stability in the country. The country was very stable. So it allowed the political elite to create a state administration which was, by African standards, pretty okay. So that was a decision they made. Let's allocate our military resources to the army. Doesn't mean that it has always to be the right decision. It depends on the, of course, international and internal environment. But what I mean is that there are always trade-offs. And so, most of the time you will see that what we would like for cultural and political reasons to happen straight away is not probably the best choice in that environment. That sometimes you have to make choices where the kind of regime you're going to have is not going to be very liberal. The kind of distribution of resources is not going to be focused on development, at least for many years, and so on and so forth. So, of course, donors, agencies like, I don't know, DFID in Britain, they're never going to buy that because actually it's written in, it's part of the task. You know, we give money for economic development. Yeah, we don't sponsor armies. We don't want to do that. We don't even want to hear about armies, you know. and that's the problem because there are all these constraints and leases and strings attached in the distribution of international development, which means that rarely this aid matches the actual needs of the country as it is. You know, some countries might say, because we are essentially a fragmented society, we actually need to develop political organizations, like a national political organization that brings the country together, kind of melting pot of the educated elite. Nobody's going to fund that. Yeah, I mean, maybe the Soviet Union was doing that in their good days. Today, nobody has any interest. If they do support political parties that we want, and we see that again in Afghanistan, also that in Iraq, typically this institution like the National Democratic Institute, the International Republican Institute, and some other from other countries, they tend to go for parties that they are built along the model. So liberal, democratic, social democratic parties, but in these countries they have no roots. So then you have a lot of parties that get 0.5, 1% of the vote. Essentially, they play no role in the political system of the country. In fact, they fragment the already small educated elite, weakening it rather than strengthening it. Again, the problem is that, you know, I think it's inevitable that whoever comes in with a bucket of money, whether in the military, in the security sector or elsewhere, will expect things to happen in a certain way. I think it's inevitable, in a sense, even fair. You know, after all, you pay, so you want to see things happen your way. But, you know, there has to be a certain degree of realism there, you know. What are real options and what are not real options? That's why you need to analyze the situation and decide, is it really a good way to spend the money? Or maybe we could spend the money in a different way and have some more achievable objectives rather than, you know, some very abstract ideas that have no way. In Afghanistan, of course, is particularly obvious because, you know, building a liberal democracy out of Afghanistan was from the beginning quite far-fetched. But I think, you know, that has happened. I mean, you could already see in Europe that the European unification, so to speak, of recent years, when they try to export the German model to Greece, that already doesn't work. Yeah, what you get is an economic disaster. And that this is not that far from Germany, culturally, compared to Afghanistan. Yeah, so this is already in Europe, and then you try to go to Asia and Africa and export models without any adaptation, any consideration on what's suitable and what is not. So we have seen in Afghanistan police officers from a country which I shall not mention wanted to replace Kalashnikovs in police hands with pistols. ignoring the fact that out there in the villages, there were gangs and bands all armed with machine guns, Kalashnikovs, rocket launchers. So you would have the police with these small handguns that will face a larger number of guys very determined and armed to the teeth. Because, it's not good for the police to go around with Kalashnikovs. And, these are weapons that cause a lot of collateral casualties, which is all true, but basically you have to face the real situation on the ground. And this is an example, of this kind of attitude that was there, particularly at the beginning. Now, of course, there's a bit more realism in places like Afghanistan, where it took 10 years. So basically, as we're winding down intervention, we're beginning to think more realistically, but it was a big waste of resources and might actually eventually even lead to failure, despite the greater realism that now is there in the policy-making circles.
Right. Let's talk a bit more about Afghanistan and how they can exercise this monopoly of violence, particularly in relation to policing. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of foreign troops there under the coalition, but the plan is to Afghanize the army and the police. What potential for success is there in a place like Afghanistan?
Well, again, I don't think Afghanistan is doomed to failure, but then again, it's a matter of what strategy you adopt and how realistic the strategy is in terms of the realities on the ground. So I think both in the police and the army, the model that is being adopted is not a realistic one because it's too close to the Western originals. And Western can also mean even Turkey for Afghanistan. Turkey as it is now is an ambitious target because Turkey now is a country with high level of education, with many years of a strong state in place. So we shouldn't look at Turkey as it is today. We should be looking at Turkey as it was in the 20s, for example. That would be more useful and more interesting. Or if you look at Italy, it shouldn't be Italy as it is today, but Italy after unification, which was, even today, I wouldn't say is the most united country in the world, but in the 1870s and 80s, that would be more suitable as an example to study for Afghanistan. So there are ways to build police forces, or for that matter, we could also look at Afghanistan before the war, because, for 40 years or 50 years, the country was somehow at peace.
True.
So we could look at those examples, which are all examples of essentially paramilitary police forces, militarized with military ranks, structured in a particular way, but their own ways of doing or function as a bureaucracy on the cheap. Yeah,
right.
So they had ways to exercise supervision and monitoring with spending very little money. Of course, one of these ways was conscription. So the police force had this layer of officers, they are volunteers, but the patrolmen were all conscripts, and basically they paid the pittance. Essentially, they didn't cost any money. And of course, I understand that conscription is not popular today, and people are conscripted are not going to be very happy. But if you look at it from the perspective of what an Afghan state could probably afford, that was, in my view, the only viable option, because anything else, Afghans will never be able to afford, at least for 30 years.
That's so, right. Yeah. I can remember a price comparison here where they said that 14 Afghan battalions of soldiers were put together at the cost of one Australian battalion of the same size. So not just the cost of the wages for the troops, but I assume the training and the equipment they're getting is of that relative difference in quality.
Yeah, of course, our standards in the West now are very high, probably could be too high, for certain times of war, because we still have models of armies that have been designed to fight blitzkriegs, whether do blitzkriegs or defense from blitzkriegs on the other side, but essentially to concentrate firepower and time and space, which is, still the Cold War, essentially. Of course, there's been some adaptation, but by and large, the adaptation was only confined to the equipment being procured. But in terms of the way they function, some reallocation of resources to special forces, but the bulk of the money is still being spent on conventional forces meant to fight conventional wars. Then when you do a counterinsurgency, essentially, and I don't mean coin as a Nazi label, but any war against an insurgency is not really a lot of firepower that you need. You know, all this firepower actually is more liability than anything else, because if you give too much firepower to a field commander, he will use it, probably not to good purpose. Yeah, so you need to have a force which is lighter, which has more manpower, because you need to occupy ground, occupy territory. And it's not a model that is very suitable, and that's why it's so expensive. It's very technologically oriented. But when you look at the Afghan army, although it's much cheaper than, say, the Australian army or any Western army, it's still very expensive for the region. Yep. The cost of an Afghan infantryman is four times the cost of an Indian infantryman, despite the fact that actually the Indian army, yeah, they have their own problems, you know, corruption, you know, there are issues in the Indian army, but it's not a complete disaster. It's a well-equipped army, a large army. When they fought, they acquitted themselves relatively well. You know, it's not, you know, the Congolese army, what I mean, you know. So this army with serious capabilities, and you talk to Indian military officers who visit Afghanistan, they will say, we couldn't believe what we saw, you know, these guys are wasting so much money. You have surgeons running around in military cars, taking their family to shopping. In India, you don't give a surgeon a car, you know, it's just like, you know, unbelievable. It's a world country, and India is much richer than Afghanistan, actually. So it's still a model of army. It's a version, a cheaper version of the American army, but still too far too close to the American army than Afghanistan can afford. And it's not only a matter of money, because money, the Americans will say, well, we'll keep paying gradually less, but we'll keep paying as long as needed. But no, it's true, because, you know, as you know, in the American system, and actually in any democracy, successive governments will make their own decision whether they want to pay or not. So you can't, nobody can honestly say now we'll keep paying for 20 years. You don't know. It depends who the president will be in the States. It depends what Congress will say. Yeah, you can't say before the elections what's going to happen. We know the record is that very rarely you have a consistent policy for 20 years. But let's take that for granted, that it will happen. The problem is still an army that the way it's designed and structured requires a complex bureaucracy to run it. Yeah, you need several layers of bureaucracy, you need heavy logistics, because now the West structure, they are not allowed, or they're not supposed to, rely on local supplies. Yeah, so they have to be supplied from the center. That means, you know, now the Americans do that, yeah, but in the future, who will do that? Because in an army where very few people can read and write, are you going to have a sophisticated logistics? You know, you can't be illiterate. I mean, you could appoint somebody there, but then you will realize you can't deliver. So there have been cases, you know, trucks of the Afghan army were supposed to do the deliveries. Of course, neither the driver nor the guy accompanying could read. They couldn't find the right direction to find the place where they had to deliver. So, and also because there is this huge discrepancy between the state sector where people are poorly paid and the private sector where people can make a lot of money. You train mechanics for years. As soon as they are good mechanics, they leave the army. Whether they even wait for the contract to end, they desert, and anyway, nobody is going to look for them. And then they will set up a workshop and make much more money in the private economy than they make in the army. But this highlights again the point I was making before. You can't have both. You know, when human resources are limited, you have to decide what's more important, what are the priorities. Now, the human resources, the educated people in Afghanistan, are spread a bit everywhere, but mostly in the NGO. In the international organization sector and in the private economy. There are few of them in government, and in particular, almost none of them in the army and the police. The people who are there are essentially people who came out of the military or police academy in the 70s and 80s. Yeah, and now, people who are coming out now, actually quite a large percentage doesn't stay in the army or the police for long. Or if they do, they will try to get some desk job in Kabul. So, there is a problem there. And I don't think the model is sustainable, even if the money will be available. Simply, they will not be able to staff the logistics of the army. And, of course, there are armies and armies. Armies can be designed in a way a particular way to fight counterinsurgency, where you don't need actually to be able to concentrate force in power and time or to a large extent, you know, in the same place, like tens of thousands of men in a place to fight a battle, because you don't fight battle like counterinsurgency. You fight an endless number of small encounters. So there are examples. In the book, I mentioned the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, who had very limited resources to fight their war, and they started fighting it following the Cuban model, which itself was based on the Soviet model, because the Cuban army was designed to repel an American invasion they were expecting, not to fight counter-guerrilla. So the conventional army was failing to contain the counter-insurgency in the early 80s. Then they, with actually some help from General Ochoa, the Cuban general, developed their own model of a counter-insurgency army, which was a mobile army, was living off the ground, based on conscript, actually. So they created a large number of mobile...
You still there?
Of course, they cut down dramatically the numbers, because after the Sandinistas lost power in 91, two elections, the first thing the new government did was to essentially disband the army. The war was over. So I don't think there's much left. They can't even now, they don't even allocate money to maintain the helicopters. So, but, you know, for a period, that model functioned and contained insurgency. And the insurgency didn't win militarily. It was the Sandinista miscalculation. They thought they would win elections if they had free and fair elections. They didn't. But militarily, the model was functioning. So it's an example how, and there are many others actually, it doesn't mean that an army has to be designed to fight World War III or Pakistan. I mean, in fact, the British army itself, for a long period, was essentially more designed to fight colonial wars than large wars in Europe, you know, most of it at least. So, you know, there are a lot of examples like that. And that they demonstrate that you can have, you just have to make, to do the thinking and the strategic planning and decide what model do we need here and what model can be implemented here. Because you might say, oh, we want to have everything, but you can't have everything. Yeah? You have to decide what the resources, financial, human, and whatever are there, what is there that, you know, we can build on. And this has not been done in Afghanistan. It might seem weird, you know, that you start spending billions of dollars without even doing some basic bigger situation on the ground. But the people were asked to design the model of the Afghan, we're not looking at Afghanistan, you know, they were not looking at the past of Afghanistan, the present of Afghanistan, the human resources of Afghanistan, doing astral considerations. The input was Pakistan doesn't want a strong Afghan army, they don't want an army with tanks and planes and trying to fight against them, essentially, fine. What we need is, there is no insurgency in 2002, so we don't need the counter-insurgency army. What we need is an army to fight off the warlords. And that's the model that has been adopted and still essentially stays the same with some adaptation. They started creating commando units, now special force units. But the bulk of the army, the fighting battalions, are still trained to fight according to the 2002 model. So the Afghans, of course, are very unhappy because they don't feel so confident that they can of the Pakistanis. They don't like the fact they don't get any heavy equipment. They don't like the fact they don't get any anti-tank training or anti-aircraft training or capacity, because, you know, for a conventional army today, consider the kind of neighbors they have, it seems odd, to be honest, you know. At the same time, they don't even get real counter-insurgency capacity. So it's an army that is designed to fight an enemy that hardly exists anymore, the warlords. And funnily enough, in 11 years, they've not been able to change the model and change the training they're imparting. This is because, of course, there are bureaucratic problems. It's not so easy for Western institutions to adapt. And that's one of the prices to pay for having strong institutions. Yeah? That then, even in this system, there are individuals who say, no, this is not how it should be. It's very difficult to change course unless there is a strong input from the political leadership, which of course has not been paying much attention to Afghanistan over the years. Different administrations whatever the rhetoric, they're not been looking very much at the Afghan war down to this level of detail. They might say, you know, they might look at the big picture, but, you know, they definitely don't think of, you know, they don't make decisions with regard to the training of the army. They let the bureaucracy lead.
Right. Well, look, Antonio, we've taken up a lot of your time today, and I want to thank you very much for doing the interview, but we'll do the traditional ending question, and that's to ask you what you're going to be working on next or now, if that's more appropriate.
Well, I hope I will be working actually on the Afghan army soon. I'm trying to raise money from that, but I don't have it yet, so it may be. Right now, I'm mainly working on the Taliban in Afghanistan. So I've been doing a lot of work on the Taliban courts, which is going to be published soon, I hope. And now I'm doing some work on other aspects of Taliban organization. So we're studying the way the Taliban have been evolving as an organization. Essentially, our belief, and this also comes from the discussion we had at the Kurdish States Research Center, we believe that organization is a good proxy for analyzing an insurgent movement because it's more observable. Yeah. So, of course, it's not the only aspect. You know, ideology is important. There are many other things that are important. But organization is the easiest things to observe. So you do a study of the organization and then organize all the residual information around that, because from organization you can infer about what the aims are. You can look at the strength of the different groups within the organization. So we are having a Leninist approach to we're looking at the organization as a key element, because that tells you a lot how strong, for example, leadership is. You know, is there organizational model being really implemented or adopted? What kind of resistance is there? It's a good benchmark for studying insurgent organizations.
Great. It sounds a lot like the work we do on organized crime. We do a lot of social network analysis and organizational structure work for the same reason, trying to generalize out of it, but it is extremely I find it extremely interesting work, and I'd love to see what you bring out. Is it going to be a book? Are you looking at articles? Or
eventually it will be a book, but funding is such that no one is going to fund a book, yeah? So you have to do it in discrete pieces, and so basically you raise money to do, like, for example, we did the Taliban courts, we did how the Taliban handles schools, we're doing the Taliban in certain parts of the country, so we do in one province, the other province, for different sorts of funding. And then at one point you have to pull it together, you know, and then at that point you may have a book, but that's more like in the background.
Okay, well, look, thank you very much again for doing the interview today. I thoroughly enjoyed the book, and I highly recommend it to a lot of people. I hope to talk to you again. If you do get another book out, especially the one about the Taliban, that would be extremely interesting. So thank you, Antonio Giustozzi.
All right, thanks to you.
You have been listening to Antonio Giustozzi talking about his new book, The Art of Coercion. I'm Mark Locks, and I will see you again soon on the New Books in Terrorism and Organized Crime channel.